to episode 458 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and today we're going to be talking about an Aftershock title. The first issue just hit last Wednesday, August 8th, and I was lucky enough to set up an interview with the writer to come on and talk about it. This is one of those books where there's so much to dig into, just so many kind of big ideas. Yeah, I'm really excited to welcome Ryan Parrott to the show. Ryan, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. That is an awesome intro, by the way. That's some epic music.
I'm glad you like it. So, well, being this is your first time on the show, Ryan. You know, we've had a lot of Aftershock creators on Aftershock Monday, so welcome to that fraternity of creators. But I always like to ask people when they're on for the first time, kind of about their history with comics. Did you grow up reading them? Like, how did you discover the wider world of comic books?
Well, thanks for having me. This is really cool. I'm excited. It's nice to be able to talk about Aftershock, this book I've been working on for, it seems like my entire life now. Comic book wise, I think the first book I ever read was like a Punisher book that my brother gave me. So my first intro to comics was like violence and lots of guns. And like, I didn't even know you had to read the captions. I thought you just read the dialogue. So like I would like burn through a comic book in like 8 minutes, and I'd be like, really? Like it takes so long. But that was like the first thing that I read, and like I think it was like Iron Man a little bit, like whatever basically he would give me. And then I do remember, I think the first real book that I remember that sort of had a big impact on me was Death in the Family. I remember I was at a comic book store with my dad, and went in and I saw the picture of that amazing iconic image of Batman holding Robin's broken body, and I was like, I want that. And so we got that, and I remember reading that book, and it is weird. Have you read that book in a while, Death in the Family?
You know, I haven't read it probably in about maybe 10 years. It's been a while.
It's a weird book to go back and read, because there's like a whole subplot where like Joker becomes like the, I think like the delegate for Iran. We always sort of like think about that book, and we're just like, oh, that book's great. It's amazing. It's so iconic, the Batman. But like, if you go back and read it, it's a little weird, like some weird stuff that happens in it. But, that was like my first intro. That was my first thing in comics. And after that, I wanted to just become like, I wanted to become a comic book artist. That was what I went all the way up to college.
Well, yeah, I now that you say that about Death in the Family, I can picture the little headdress that Joker wears.
Exactly, yeah. If they made the animated movie of that, I don't necessarily think they would put that part in. At least, maybe they did, and I missed it. But yeah, it's an odd book. It's amazing. That one kind of said everything. I mean, I remember I went to the library, and I got the Bob Kane autobiography, Batman and Me. I read that. Wow. Which was amazing. And then next to it was the Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, which I got that. I remember taking that home and reading that and being like, and like getting halfway through the book and finding the part with the girl with like the swastikas covering her breasts. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know if I should be reading this. but that was sort of the way I went into comic books. Like, it was adult, and then I went really far adult, and then back into all of sort of like modern comics and the more, you know, kid friendly stuff.
Yeah, how much older is your older brother than you?
Well, he's about 6 years older than me. So, like, he was just like, yeah, this is the only way to go. You know, you got to go. Like, he had, like, I remember on his like mantle, he would have, like, Preacher. And he had, and like, I didn't know what it was. I just saw this weird picture of, like, a guy just looking over a flaming church and stuff. Like, I was always like, what the heck is that stuff? And what else did he have? He had some, like, he had a lot more of the darker stuff, like, the stuff that I've long since read now. And it's like, oh, now I get why people love comic books.
Yeah, exactly. It's what's possible in the medium. Now, you mentioned you wanted to be an artist. So when did the change happen where you kind of shifted over to the writing side of things?
Well, like, I grew up, like, I sort of was, like, 12, I think, when Image came out. And so, like, when Image hit, like, I think I bought every single Image book, even the not great ones. Just because, like, I loved the artists. Like, I loved Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee and Eric Larson. Like, Dale Keown was, like, one of my favorite artists. Unfortunately, it took him, like, 10 years to do a book.
Yeah.
I got the Marvel, that giant Marvel tryout book. You know, the one that you could do pencils on and had Spider-Man. Like, I got that thing. So I was into it. I really wanted to do that. I went to college thinking that that's what I was going to do. So I went to digital. I went to do, I could draw a little bit. So I was like, I want to do that. So I went and basically got a digital media. And then I was just like, man, I do not have the work ethic to sit in front of a, you know, in front of a desk every day for like 8 hours a day drawing. I like it, but I just didn't have that work ethic. So I just sort of thought that was going to be it. And then I sort of wandered into, I was like, okay, so what else is there? And I was like, so I kind of got into film and television at that point and sort of shifted over into that.
And then at some point you're like, well, wait, if I can, I mean, it's all telling stories, right? I mean, even sequential art is telling stories. So if you're a storyteller at heart, you know, maybe you're better with the words than the actual drawing, right?
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I realized, is that I liked drawing, but the things that I got really excited about were the stories. Like, that's what I was drawn towards. I was drawn towards the characters and the story. I loved the art, but I was like, I wanted to tell the stories too. I think that's one of the things I really liked about Image, was it was the artists finally started taking ownership over some of the stories and like writing their own stories. So it felt like there was like this auteur movement that I was like in the middle of, and like, and sort of missed and thought that was going to be it. And so, yeah, that's what I did. I went into that and went to film school, and it wasn't actually until like film school, like halfway through film school with some buddies, like they got me back into comic books. Like, one of the guys I hung out with a lot was like, hey, we're going to go to this place in San Diego. Went down to there, and I was like, oh my God, like, I found, like, I started reading stuff again. I think that's what, I think that might've been the first time I got Watchmen, was like when I was in college.
Oh, wow.
Which is late to the game. Yeah. I know, I feel bad. But like, I got it, but like, to read it in college, holy smokes. Like, that issue, I still think, I will make the argument that I think it's the fourth issue. It's the Dr. Manhattan on Mars.
Yeah.
Issue. It's the, I think that is the greatest issue a comic book ever made. It, like, it changed the way I looked at time. And like, that's and it was just like, it's so brilliant, and it's heartbreaking and amazing. And it's an origin story that plays with the medium in a way I'd never seen before. And like, that's when I was just like, oh my God, I gotta keep working. I gotta keep doing comic books. Or at least I gotta find a way to get into, back into this medium. And then I got lucky enough years later, when I met Kyle, and worked with him, that I was able to sort of find my way into comic books.
Yeah. What are some of your previous works? I know you've done some work, I think with Boom and IDW. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Luckily, my first, like I said, I met Kyle in college. I wrote a short film for a buddy of ours, and I was on set, and there's nothing for a writer to do, when you're on set. So I was sort of there, and there was a guy doing sound, and he was in between takes, he had his laptop open, and he was working on this student film they made, which is a superhero movie. And I'm like, what is that, man? And he's like, oh, that's my student film. And we start talking, and it's Kyle Higgins. And so, like, we just started becoming friends, and then he ends up eventually moving up to LA, and like, we ended up moving pretty close to each other. So we just started talking a lot. We started hanging out, and he was trying to get into comic books at that time. He just, I think, kind of just made his way in. He was like pitching a lot of ideas, and I was like, well, I'm around, man. Like, let's just start throwing ideas around. So he would like, I helped him with some stuff, and he got Gates of Gotham with Scott Snyder. Mm-hmm. And as he was writing that, I sort of helped him break some stuff in. I just put it on a sounding board. And then in the middle of that, he went from doing like two or three little like one stories to writing two of the new 52. He was writing Deathstroke and Nightwing overnight.
Yep.
So, excuse me. And so what happened, he was like, oh my gosh, I can't finish this book in the time that I have. Hey, Ryan, you're around. You want to help me write this? Like, write the last three issues. So I was like, you mean my first comic book's going to be Batman? Yeah, I'll do that. That'll be great. I can do that. So like, I literally went right into it and started writing it with him. And that was, so I got that. And then because I had written that, I was actually an assistant at Bad Robot at the time, trying to make my way into film and television. And they had the new Star Trek movies come out. And because they were like, oh, we're thinking about doing some comic books there. And I was like, well, I wrote Batman. And the fact that I told them that I had written Batman gave me a lot more credit than I probably deserved. And so they were like, well, are you interested in doing Star Trek? And so I got to do some of the Star Trek books with Mike Johnson. It was sort of an arranged marriage, but we became really good friends, and I worked on that for a while. And then because I'd done that, I got on a panel at WonderCon, and I met an editor, and they were like, hey, we're doing Power Rangers. Boom was that Flevin, and she was just like, hey, you know, I like your other stuff. So I got to write that. And then it's this weird sort of like, you know what they always say, it's like all who you know.
Yep.
That's exactly how it happened. It was just sort of this weird snowball of just lucky opportunities.
Yeah. So that's the thing about comics, you know, it's kind of a small industry, and if you're professional and you do good work and you're on time and you're nice, you can get work, but here's the thing. And Kyle will tell you this as well. There's gotta be talent behind it, because maybe you'll get a book or two, but the work will dry up, you know, really quickly. But, yeah, it's true. It's a lot about like luck and timing and everything. But yeah, Kyle's one of my favorite writers. I think I've read everything the guy's ever done, especially Cowl, Hadrian's Wall, his Dead Hand series is coming out right now. It's fantastic. He really is one of my favorite
characters.
And he's a cool guy too. He's one of my favorite people. A great storyteller. So if you have the same kind of sensibilities, because I'm not as familiar with your work as I am with Kyle's, but if you have the same kind of sensibilities, then you're going to be hearing from me a lot. And I'll be a fan very, very quickly.
Yeah, well, Kyle's prolific, man. He's been writing for a while. It's been the fun thing about, like, it's one of the guilty pleasures of having, like, a friend who's, like, you know, pretty well known in comics. Is like, I've learned, it's like, I never go in, like, completely clean to a project. Like, I'm always, he's always working them over in his head, and like, we'll have coffee and talk and stuff like that. And he's like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this new thing. So it's always fun when he'll throw me like what the original nuggets of ideas are. Yeah. And then like 9 months later, the book comes out and I read it and how different it is and how it's changed and evolved in that time and stuff. And he's been so like, I would not have a career in comic books without Kyle. He's a good friend and he's a really great collaborator and he really has been so generous with, you know, just so helping me and help. Like, right now, I'm currently writing Go-Go Power Rangers for Boom, and he's doing the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, series. So we actually are doing a tie-in together, which happened completely by accident in a weird way. Like, he didn't get me that job. We just like, oh, they didn't even know we knew each other when we got a gig. and we've been working, and so working on him and that, he's been so helpful and generous and like, you know, breaking story with him for real, as opposed to when we were doing it for fun and cop shops, but really awesome.
Yeah, a consummate storyteller for sure. So, well, let's get into the title that you have for Aftershock. That's the reason you're here. It's Volition.
Yeah.
Why don't you give our listeners an idea of what the title's all about?
Okay. Well, Volition is something I've been working on for a while now. What's the log line? It's hard to pitch this thing in a log line, but I'll do my best. In brief, it's about sort of two robots. It's in the future. So two robots from sort of different backgrounds, they escape a decommissioned facility, which is like a prison kind of thing, and then go on a quest to sort of find their creator. So like the quick version of it's like Bonnie and Clyde meets Blade Runner. And it takes place in a world where like we created robots and they became conscious, but instead of like trying to overthrow and destroy us like everybody always does, they just sort of live amongst us and lead normal lives and they're just like normal machines. But with normal machines, the problem is like the next version always better. So they try to upgrade and stay relevant and so on and so forth. So it sort of creates this sort of underground like upgrade facilities, which leads to a virus called Rust that sort of destroys robot consciousness. I know that's a lot, but it's basically these two robots who are, you know, kind of on the run trying to find the creator and sort of save all of robot kind. Like, you know, just like a normal robot story.
Yeah, like a regular, you know, run-of-the-mill robot story. So this is your first creator-owned work, is that right?
Yeah, this is my first creator-owned book, which is a lot harder than I thought it would be. Like, I always thought, oh, yeah, creator-owned books are great because you guys can make your own rules and do whatever. But the thing is, that's the problem, is you have to make your own rules.
Yeah, and you've got to make all the decisions.
And so, it's a lot easier sometimes when you're doing someone else. Like Power Rangers is a lot easier because it's like, I know the formula for that story before I ever wrote a page. But when you do your own creators and stuff, the beauty is it's a blank page and you can do anything you want with it. But the terrifying thing is it's a blank page and you can do anything you want with it.
Yeah. And there's the framework is not necessarily, I know Aftershock helps with a lot of that, but there are a lot
more
decisions to be made because, you know, like you said, it's complete creative freedom. So what was it about this story, this idea that compelled you, like, okay, I'm going to do a creator own this, and because I'm sure as many storytellers do, you have a lot of ideas. What was it about this particular one you wanted it to be like, okay, this is the one?
Well, it's one of these things that's sort of like percolating in your brain for a really long time. And like, I was just on a panel at Comic-Con, and somebody on the panel said something I thought was really cool. It was like that science fiction is one of the few genres where location is actually a character. And I've always sort of loved quest stories that are just an excuse to sort of explore worlds, right? So I worked on the television series Revolution, which was exactly that. It was just a series of stories that sort of explore how people dealt with life without electricity and technology. So I wanted to try and create something that did that, where, you know, it was just an excuse to have these two people sort of go on a journey through this world and just see how robots and humans could live side by side and explore that in sort of a long form. Because movies, you know, they move so quickly. Like if you see iRobot or AI or any of the movies that have dealt with artificial intelligence, stuff like that, it's like you have like about 10 minutes to build the world. Then you have to meet the character, and then everything just is, it's a train out of the station. Yeah. And I just thought there was something really cool about doing sort of a longer road story about people who you can really dig into sort of the ideas of, the reality of the situation and the concepts of how, these two groups would sort of intermingle and work side by side and come into conflict and stuff like that. So like, this was not, it was literally more of a, I had an idea for a world and then I was like, oh, how do I explore that world and that concept thoroughly?
And you decided to do it, at after, you know, we talked a little about, image, you know, and Image has, it's, you know, it's positives and negatives, like, you know, any publisher, Aftershock offers a little more framework. But what was it exactly? Like, how did you get involved with doing this title, there with, Mike and Lee and Joe and the rest of the guys?
Well, exactly. That it's kind of weird. I had sort of two avenues in. Mike Martucci, the editor in chief there. He was actually my first editor on Gates of Gotham. Like, he was the one I had my first job with. So he saw me when I was just completely blue and, I mean, sort of completely green and didn't know what I was doing. And I think he always, I think he just appreciated me coming on at the last hour and helping out a little bit. So we always sort of, we kept in contact over the years and always wanted to try and do something together. And then at the same time, Lee Kramer, who's the president there, we actually share a mutual friend. I lived with, for like 8 years in LA, I lived with a guy, a friend of mine, and they were both friends. He's getting married, he's in his wedding and everything. So, like, I actually had drinks with Lee before Aftershock even existed, before it was even a company. I had drinks with Lee because they're like, oh, you like comic books, we should talk, and we hang out. And in the middle of that, I was like, oh, you know, there's this guy named Mike Martz who's awesome. I think he just left Marvel or something like that. And I was just like, hey, you guys should meet. He's a really great guy. And not knowing that Mike Martz was literally already in the city and that he and Lee were already starting a company. So like, I feel like I actually created Aftershock, just by being around him. But like, it was such a weird, so like, I kind of knew the people at the top. And the nice thing was in the time since I'd worked with Mike, and the time I met Lee, like, I'd already sort of built my own sort of career. So when I came back to them and they already had their company and they were starting off and they were explaining to me what they were trying to do with Aftershock and how they were trying to, you know, dig into genres and make some really sort of really some high concept ideas and build up those worlds, and they were looking for stuff. I had this in my back pocket and I was like, oh, that would be perfect for them. So it was just a weird sort of synergy of like same thing. Like, I knew them, they knew me. We liked each other. This idea happened to fit into what they were trying to do. So I was very lucky and they've been so, you know, helpful and walked me through so many as my first creator own book. They've been so monumentally helpful in making sure that I, you know, get everything out on time and figure things out. And when I have problems, I couldn't be more grateful for what they've given.
Yeah, they're an incredible company, and yeah, everybody over there, from Joe, Mike, Lee, Lisa, they're all awesome. It's part of the reason I do Aftershock Mondays. I mean, almost every title they put out is quality. So you know, got a signal boost, because I think
it would be easy for me to sit here and be like, oh yeah, they're all amazing, and not read any of them, but I actually read them. Like, yeah. I think Baby Teeth is fantastic. I think Animosity is amazing. What else am I missing? Rough Riders, like, they have a lot. There's so many different types of books, and all of them have such unique styles, but they all have like something, there's like a passion behind all of them. I was actually reading Animosity as I was writing, as I was like developing Volition, and it changed. Reading Marguerite's work actually was changing the way that I was writing my series. So that was like, so yeah, if you haven't checked out, I mean, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you've tried, if it's Aftershock Monday, they've tried the book, but man, they have some really good stuff.
Yeah, they really do. Let's talk a little bit about your collaborator, your artist on the series. Omar, is it Francia? Is that how you say it?
Francia, I think, actually. Francia. Oh God, you know what? I actually never said it out loud. So I'll just go with that. Yeah.
So is he someone that you knew ahead of time, or was that somebody that Mike suggested? Like, how did that come? How did he get involved in the project?
Well, we've been worked on this thing for years. And he came on the project. When I brought them the project, I think they had kept their eye on him for a little while, and they were like, oh, when I was like, oh, it's about robots and this, and he was like, they were like, yo, we have this guy named Omar, he's fantastic, you should take a look at his stuff, and they sent me his stuff, and I was like, absolutely, if he wants to do the book, let's do it. And so they brought him to me, And he does, he has an engineering background as well. So the fact that it's so much of these, so many, you know, robots and stuff like that, he has gone some deep diving in regards to some of the designs he's created and some of the things that he wants to explore. Like one of the great things about him is that he's just got like an incredible logic filter. Like he really wants to understand, you know, not just who the characters, how they should look, but like the reality of how they got there. Like we have long spiraling emails about the evolution of the robot world, their look, like why some robots look human, why some don't, and how that informs sort of on the characters. A lot of this stuff has sort of ended up in the book in other ways because of how deep he wants to dig into this stuff. But it's really sort of forcing the drill home the reality even when I didn't want to. You know what I mean? Like he's like, why is this way and why is this way? And I'm like, I don't know, man, just draw it. But like he asked some great questions and he's been such an incredible collaborator and I can't wait for people to see the work. It's really every single panel is like a cover. He's just amazing. He made me realize, oh man, it was a really good decision not to go into drawing contests because I would never be able to compete with him.
Yeah. I had seen the preview pages. But then when we set up this interview, I got a chance to, you know, take a look at the full issue one. And I was just like, oh my God, it's just gorgeous, to look at. And it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that he has, an engineering background because you're right. I mean, just the attention to detail and the way he kind of lays out, the action in the panels. It's spectacular. So, congratulations. I mean, to have somebody like this on your first creator owned, you have to be over the moon.
I know, I'm just completely spoiled. And like, you can see it too, like a lot of the detail stuff, like there, I remember I wrote in this, like on page like five, I'm like, let's see a picture of a brain. And I was like, I'm just expecting to see like, you know, him just like pull something on, like, you know, just a sketch. And I look at it and you can see like all the neurons he drew in and his coloring is because he colors the book himself as well. Oh my gosh. Like there's this, the shot of the hospital that they worked at, Virtual Heart, is like that. I saw that page and I'm like, my God, like there's this sunset in the background. It's just like, it's not fair. Like I should not be getting somebody like him on a work order. Cause I feel bad. I've gone back and reread my first script cause I'd written it and I was like, still kind of green. And I was like, I could have done a much better job for you, man. I'm so sorry. We're learning to work with each other and it's been a fun collaboration.
Yeah, when you guys first started working together, like you first saw his work and decided to bring him on the book, did you, like, was it talking about like the tone and feel of the world first, or was it like specifically the main characters? Like, how did you start? I'm curious about that process. Like, you know, here's the idea of the story, but now we have to decide how the world looks. Cause like you yourself said, a lot of times in sci-fi, the setting is a character. So was it kind of building the shell, or did you concentrate on kind of the main characters first and build out from there?
Well, it was kind of like like rings on a tree a little bit. Like it started with like, okay, here are the characters. And I was like, so there's Hale and then there's Amber and then this is the way. Like this is who he is and this is who she is. And these are the people that are part of his little group. And this is kind of my general feeling about the world. And what he did was he started working on Hale. He was like, okay, so Hale's this way. What his friends should look this way. And if his friends look this way, then they should, and she's like, it came to, it was sort of this thing where like everything, every choice we made asked another question. And there posed another question, and there we have to answer that one, which would pose another question, which was answer that one and pose another question. Like for instance, one of the reasons I was like, well, I want Amber to be. So we're like, Hale is a construction robot, right? And so we're like, okay, if he's a heavy duty construction robot, he would be strong and sturdy, and he wouldn't necessarily have to look human. He would be just as he's made for manual labor. While on the other side, Amber is a nurse. And so Amber would be dealing with people all the time. So she would be sort of a customer service thing. So it would be more beneficial if she looked human to deal with human patients. And so when we dealt with that, we were like, okay, well, you know, Hale is more of a construction, if he's a construction means he's like sort of a, you know, like a blue collar kind of guy. So he's probably on the poor side. So maybe there's people who are like poor in the robot world. Do they embrace in their culture? Do they embrace the idea that they don't look like humans? You know what I mean? Like, they don't want to look like people. At the same time, maybe wealthier robots who have better professions, maybe they want to look more like the people that they're around. Like, it was this thing that, like, it started creating all of these interesting cultural questions that just started to spiral, and every single question we answer open up another one. I mean, it's just, like, it, and not all of it, I wish all of it could get in the book, but it was sort of like, oh, wow. Like, it just made you go, like, it gets frustrating to the point where, like, do I have to answer everything? And then you're like, yeah, you do, because you're building the world, man. It's your own thing. It's all in your head. So that's the early stages, if that makes sense. Helpful.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love to hear about that kind of stuff, because it's something that's so valuable to the listeners, and especially people that maybe don't understand kind of the behind the scenes of comics. Especially because so often you see writers credited as, you know, the creator, the storyteller, and sometimes to the point where the artist is, you know, barely mentioned in one sentence or not at all, kind of as an afterthought. And so I'm glad to hear you talk about the fact that, you know, what Omar was asking is actually informing the story. It's what's so important and so special about sequential art and comic book storytelling. The artist is, you know, it's 50-50, man. And, you know, I don't like the fact that sometimes the artists, so often actually, the artists get shortchanged as part of the storytelling team. You know, it's just, they're thought of as kind of the drawing monkey, like the writer is like the end all be all. And that's just not the case.
Well, it's funny, in my lifetime, and I don't know about yours, like, it's funny how you've seen it shift. Like, in the early image days, it was all about the artists. The artists were key, and the stories were almost secondary, you know? And it was this thing of, like, it was J. Scott Campbell and Joe Madureira and all those guys that I kind of grew up idolizing and stuff like that. Like, I didn't care what the story was. I just wanted to see them draw, and I was into that, right? And then in somewhere, I think as we started to see sort of this proliferation of comics, you know, sort of taking and seizing, you know, higher, like, movies and television and all that stuff, I think we've seen the pendulum sort of swing more towards the writer in the same way that we've seen the pendulum swing from actors to showrunners in television, because it's where the stories are coming from or being generated. There seems to be this idea of, like, well, we want to get to the man behind the curtain a little bit, you know? But with artists, I look at it this way, and I've gotten the luxury of being able to work with Dan Mora, who is one of the most empowering, one of the most amazing artists I've ever worked with. It is so much like a writer-director relationship where, like, you write the page and then you give it to your artist. And when you get it, my favorite part of the process of writing comic books is the day you get back that first page they've done what was on there. But when you were lucky to work with somebody like Omar, and you're looking at somewhere like Dan, they take your ideas and they make them so much better. They make you look like you know what you're doing if you look at some of my script pages and what the actual finished product is, oh my gosh, like the amount of detail and style and direction of the eye through the page is all so much on the artist, and I take complete credit for it. but I really do feel like when you have a great relationship, like when you get into a rhythm with a good artist, and you can take your hands off the writers can take their hands off the wheel a little bit and let them run. But also the fun is to try and come up with really fun things for them to draw. Like, I think that's the key. It's sort of, you know, it needs to sort of be a quid pro quo kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we are pretty close in age. So I do agree with you. I found it interesting when the pendulum swung back to the writers, because I had grown up in that time where, you know, I first started reading comics and didn't pay that much attention to creators. And then, you know, as I started getting to high school and became more familiar and started following some creators, yeah, that was the age of, you know, McFarlane and Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and all those guys, Eric Larson, Mark Silvestri, they were superstars, right? And so then I thought, okay, well, yeah, it must kind of be cyclical. Like, sometimes Marvel's more popular, sometimes it's DC. Like, maybe it goes in cycles. Like, sometimes the writers are kind of at the forefront, sometimes it's the artists. And then as I learned more about comic history, I learned that, so that era of the quote unquote superstar artists, J. Scott Campbell and those guys, that's kind of the outlier. You know, prior to that, it's been about the writer. And since then, it's been all about the writer. But I think it's starting to change now. I think people are starting to understand that it really is a 50-50 process, especially as we've seen it kind of evolve. We see, like, fewer inkers and more artists doing, you know, tighter pencils and more finished work. So it really is, like you said, the director writer, that's a good analogy.
Isn't it crazy though to think though, like, could you imagine Saga without Fiona? Like, could you, like, I could, like, she, like, I think Brian K. Vaughan is amazing, but like the art and the style that she brings and the way that she controls that, I couldn't imagine, like, I think it's when you find those great pairings, when you find those people, those writers and those artists who work together, like, at least when I read comic books, like with East of West and stuff like that, with like Nick and John and Jonathan Hickman, like when you get the right pairing, the right style and the right art, the writer, and they trust each other enough to give each other the freedom to work. And then I think the other thing is like they consistently keep coming out with the work. I think when comic books, when the sad thing is when a comic book starts to go off, it takes too long. And it just like you lose that momentum in the story. It's really hard as a writer, actually, sometimes when things take too long, but I don't know. I'm sort of going off the topic, but like, I think when you find those great pairings, they become, it's nice when they can prop each other up and they both sort of respect and understand each other. And like, I sometimes live into that idea of like, oh yeah, the writer is the guy, but like, man, it really is. It is such a, having been on the other side and worked in that world, it is incredible how important the fence web is.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of those, it's a perfect example of the sum's greater than the parts, right? Like, I think other collaboration team that have been working together for a while that I'll mention, one Eisner's this year at San Diego is Tom King and Mitch Gerrits, personally. I mean, that their Mr. Miracle work and also their Sheriff of Babylon. I mean, same thing with Brian and Fiona, as you mentioned. I can't imagine anybody else, like Mr. Miracle wouldn't be the book that it is if it wasn't Tom writing it and Mitch drawing it. It just wouldn't. It wouldn't work.
I was actually at Comic Con. I went to the Tom King panel, and they talked about the nine panel yeah. format and all that stuff. And it was funny, like Tom looks at that as in a way of sort of like, this is the way I want the book drawn. But the cool thing is the artist is like, I'm going to take your concept and I'm going to invert it and use it and make it my own. Like, I just think that's a really great example of. You can look at that and be like, okay, the artist is obvious. The writer is giving him a very, very strict regimen. But the great thing is that the artist is looking at that and going, okay, how can I change it? How can I subvert it? How can I take this format of the nine panels and do interesting and creative things with it? And that's a great example of two people who just work hand in glove.
Yeah. Like Mitch is like, how can I make it better? I was at that panel too. I was at that panel too. That's so funny. We were in the same room. Oh, and didn't even realize it.
We should have just hung out and talked there.
Yeah, we should have. If I'd only known. All right. Well, let's steer back to Volition, because it sounds like you and I could talk comics all day, but we want our listeners to have an idea of some of the big ideas, but behind the story. So artificial intelligence as a concept, obviously been around, a long time, Isaac Asimov and all the tropes that go with it, robots are going to rise up or technology is going to rise up, enslave humans or annihilate us, we have the war with the machines a la Terminator. All that's been done before.
Yeah.
So you, in the first few pages, you just totally throw that out the window. You're like, okay, what happens if we have AI and instead of any of that stuff happening, the robots just decide, hey, we just want to be like regular beings. We just want to be like everybody else, live a life, have a family. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why was that where you wanted to go with this?
Well, it's funny. You're right. It's a very saturated genre with a lot of stories in it. But like, it kind of came, the whole idea, it sort of came out of a frustration that every robot movie sort of turns into a slave uprising story.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at, like, the actual history of this century in slavery, like, African-Americans didn't win their freedom and then start a war. they wanted the same rights and privileges and opportunities as everybody else. And which they're still fighting for today. So when I realized that was something that, like, the one example in history of that, or not the one example, but, like, the most recent history of that, I was like, well, why don't I kind of deal with that with robots? Like, why don't I apply that to, let's use the examples from the past to inform on the future. So I thought there was a chance to sort of create like a unique sci-fi world that was sort of grounded in aspects of reality. That's where the whole thing came out of. It was just because it just felt like, yeah, I get why it's done that way, because it's streamlined and, Skynet is such it's like, that's what we all think of when we hear about AI, we think Skynet.
Yeah,
but to be actually, well, as I've been, following more about what's going on in AI in the world, it's like it's actually much more like there's going to be a bunch of different AIs all sort of fighting against each other in the future, protecting each country, protecting each industry, corporation, all stuff. So to me, I was like, that's a lot of different points of view, and there's no way you're going to be able to unite all those points of view. So what if all those points of view just want to live their lives? That's where it just came out of sort of that frustration.
Yeah, there's so many interesting ideas with AI that, you know, we can talk about it. You know, you yourself, another part of the reason that it always ends up being like a war or annihilation or enslavement or whatever is, in a way, we as humans know that we're really messing up the planet. We're kind of hurtling ourselves toward like self-extinction. And you think about machines making logical choices, and it, you know, if they like kind of like the Will Smith, you know, I, Robot movie, it's like, well, I need to protect humans, and the logical extension of that is to take away their ability to make decisions because they invariably make the wrong ones. So it's kind of interesting. But when you with what you're doing in this book, it's like, okay, so humans create AI, many AIs, and they are just as varied as we are, because in a way, you can think of it as humans kind of playing God, right? And so if we're and you know, we're all unique as beings, so if we're creating these different AIs and they are an extension of us as humans, then it stands to reason that they would all be different too. But then you can also add in the fact that we as a species are imperfect. So the creations of these AIs, they're going to be imperfect too. And that's an interesting idea to talk about in terms of artificial intelligence, because I think so often we do think of it as just ones and zeros. And so they're all going to be the same, and they all are going to base their decisions on logic. But you've really kind of flipped that on its head and said, no, they're all going to be different, and they're all going to be unique, and maybe they don't make the right decisions either. Maybe theirs not all based on logic. So was that something you did consciously, or did it just sort of happen as you were building the story, or have you even thought about it in that depth?
Well, yeah, without sort of giving away the point of the book, like, yeah, that's exactly part of what the whole concept came out of. You know, like the way I'd originally talked to you about it was, I was like trying to explain how the robots are. Like, I was thinking about, like, okay, imagine like you have like an iPhone factory, and they have like, they build 100 iPhones, right? They all come out of exactly the same way. They come out, well, with a few mess ups, but they all come out with like the same programming, the same base OS, all that stuff, right? And then the minute they're turned on, from that point on, each one of them lives a completely different life. Because you go, look, I'm not sure if you have an iPhone, we could probably put our two iPhones on the table, and they would look, they would look similar on the outside, but they'd be so different. They would be completely, they do different things, they function different ways, because they just live different lives. And so to me, that was like, that's a cool concept to look at all the robots. So you have like a base model, and then the minute, like, imagine like a whole host of robots are made on the same day. They all step out, but from the minute they step out, they're all trying to find their own identity. They're all sort of building their own points of personalities and stuff like that. So like, of course they'd be flawed. They'd make wrong decisions. They'd be introduced to the same different levels of information. Like, they would have different experiences. So I felt like they aren't going to all be like, they're all not going to be Skynet. They're not all going to be perfect intelligence and perfect, comprehension. So yeah, and that was sort of illustrated in kind of the character. Like, that's what I liked, the idea that the two characters in the story, Amber and Hale, are from two completely different worlds, even though they're robots. One has grown up, Hale was a construction robot that after a few years basically discovered that the next model had been made, which was faster, smarter, and better, and he basically was obsolete. And so he couldn't get legal jobs anymore, and therefore ended up going sort of into the illegal territory and became, you know, a criminal because of that. And so, and then you have Amber, who's on the other side of that, who is somebody who has, grew up in an affluent environment, and basically was there to help people all the time, and was, you know, trying and had watched Russ just eat away all the patients. So when these two people come together to go on this mission to basically find God, in a sense, or find their creator, they're both going in for completely different reasons. Like, Hale's like, I want to find this person so I can punch him in the face for saying, why didn't you do a better job building us? And then you have Amber, who's like, I want to come to them and say, hey, can you save us? Can you made us, but can you save us? And what you just said about this idea of flawed people making flawed creatures, the thing that's what, that you know is going to be a problem is they're going to a person that they, that, you know, is obviously not God and obviously does things for selfish reasons and has good reasons and good and bad reasons. So it's the stories about them coming, trying to find God, the mission to get there. And then when they do, what does that God say to them in regards to, like, why did you do this? Can you save us? And that's kind of the point of the series. So yeah, it's all the things you talked about. It's about this idea that, you know, the minute you, like, the thing is, like, the minute you open a car, drive a car off the lot, you've already decreased in size. The minute you turn your phone on, it's starting to break. So it makes sense that they wouldn't be perfect. And I just think those make some more interesting characters.
Yeah, and a really interesting story too, because, you know, you kind of hit on it yourself there. You're talking about, you know, okay, they're in search of their God, which clearly is not a God. And with technology we have today, you know, we're not there yet with AI, you know, to the level it's at in the book. But, you know, with so many things that we do, like stem cell research and genetic manipulation is something that jumps out at me when I'm talking about this. You know, we spend so much time exploring and researching and figuring out how to do things, and maybe not enough time thinking, should we be doing this? Right?
Like, I mean, dude, if you watch Jurassic Park, that's certainly the case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it's funny. It's funny you say that. Like, it's weird. Like, one of our greatest, and I'm not the most intelligent guy in the world, but like, it's just like one of our greatest gifts and maybe our most tragic flaw is our ego, in the sense that, like, we think there's literally no problem that we can't solve.
Yep.
I mean, there's no issue we can't work our way out of, if we have to, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's sort of allowed us to achieve so much. Like the idea that we're like, we can make it to the moon. Like, sure. You know what I mean? Like, we just thought we could do it and we did. And like, and the weird thing is we technically haven't found a problem that we can't solve yet. Like, because we're still here. Now, granted, something bad could happen and it might cost us 2/3 of the world's population, but then we might solve it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird thing to have an ego that basically says we can do anything and any problem that we face, we will eventually solve it. Which is awesome and also terrifying because, you know, a lot of people are going to get hurt. So like, I totally agree with you. I think this idea of like, I think we think it's okay to try anything because we can solve the next problem, which is just pure hubris.
Yes, exactly. We can solve the next problem until we can, and by then it's too late.
Until we can, exactly.
So something else you said when you were talking about Amber and Hale going on this quest, and I'm sure you weren't even aware that you used the term, but you're talking about them coming together, and you said when these two people come together, they're robots, but you're referring to them as people. So it's the idea after having read the first issue of, you know, the idea of life, what does it mean to be alive, and go in search of your creator. And it's almost like you're using, you know, quote unquote robots as a stand in for people because they are so much further behind in the context of the story with, you know, how long their society's been around. And so in a way you're almost making a commentary on the human condition, but with using robots, you know, as far as like struggle for survival and dominance and evolution, you know, with Hale being replaced and the class warfare, the have and the have nots. Again, I have to ask, is that something that came about as a byproduct as you're building the story, or was it something you thought about early on that yeah, this is something that is worth exploring as well?
I'm sure you're like me. Like I remember the 4th of July, was the best part about the 4th of July was not the fireworks and not the hot dogs and all that stuff. It was about the Twilight Zone marathon, that you would just like watch every episode. And like all the ones that mattered were ones that were literally using science fiction as a way to sort of explore and see the human, you know, the human condition.
Right.
And I think every good sci-fi should do that. I don't think there's any sci-fi that doesn't do it in some, you know, like, it's like, I think whenever you create any sci-fi world, you're going to step into those themes and ideas, even if indirectly, you know. But yes, I was playing with the idea of, this being sort of like a part racial societal allegory. And also, I guess I would call it like a culture study, you know. I mean, I don't mean to get too heady or anything like that, but it's like, if you look at sort of like, okay, this is going to sound really weird, but if you look at sort of like prehistoric times, right? humans built like entire cultures out of sort of like just like the simple basic desires to like find food and safety and procreate. That's about it. Everything we do, the money and art and work, it's all sort of grew out from like survival and sexuality. Like that's everything, right? But robots would have different base desires. If, I mean, gender isn't even the same thing for that. Like they get, I mean, you know what I mean? Like there's not male and female robots, but yet in my world, there are male and female robots, or they have sort of chosen which gender they want to associate with, which is obviously a very topical situation we're dealing with. So like for me, a big part of the story is to sort of use the quest to sort of explore a robot, how a robot culture would evolve over time. And like, what would be important to that? So like all that stuff we talked about, survival, dominance, evolution, class warfare, it all comes, the idea is, I think if God, you know, God willing, the series goes on long enough, I will be able to sort of have our robot, have my two people, you know, follow through and see little elements of all of that world. Like for instance, in issue four, they're going to go to a church that worships the singularity. Like they think, like they believe, like robots believe in that day when all robots will be one conscious, the Skynet concept. And like for them, that's God. They believe they will evolve. There's a religion about robots who believe that someday they will evolve all to one conscious, which is kind of what humans believe, sort of. Like when we die, maybe we all kind of go to heaven and become one with everything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It depends on how you look at religion. So I just love that. That came out of, oh my gosh, if there are people, if like you said, I made the mistake of calling them people. If the robots had evolved and become conscious, they're going to develop their own beliefs, their own ideas about everything. And it was just fun to sort of, so you end up having to answer all of those things if you want to make them relatable enough to be able to explore what it means to be human.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I can't wait to read more. Like right when I heard the title Volition, I'm like, Volition, the power of using one's will. And then I read what the story was about. You probably could tell how excited I am. So congratulations on the series. I can't wait to read more. I hope it does really, really well. And I hope you get to tell more stories beyond just the story of Amber and Hale on their quest that we can, you know, cause it's such a rich world you've created already. And I've only read one issue. So I hope it does really well and we get to have more stories, cause the world you've created, it just lends itself to, you know, any myriad of stories because, you know, you yourself said all these robots are unique, right? So there's millions of robots. There's really millions of stories to tell, and so much to explore. Yeah. I mean, look at, we've gone, I blinked my eyes and we've been talking for almost an hour here about this, and we could go on for a long time. I have a feeling.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm very long-winded, and
I love it. I love it. It's exactly why I do this, and exactly why I love comics. Especially, I've read so many comics in my 40 years of reading comics. Now it's like I still enjoy the superhero stuff, but I'm as I get older and more mature, you know, none of us are getting any younger. I really find the books that make me think and give me kind of more value. I'm thinking about it even when I'm, you know, not reading it, driving in the car or whatever. Those are some of my favorite books, and I have a feeling Volition is going to be exactly that.
Well, hopefully I do it justice. Like you said, I've thrown a lot of big ideas out there today. You know, for those of you who are listening, thank you. I apologize. And I'm like, what is he talking about? He seems like he sounds like he knows what he's talking about, but he doesn't. But like, I really try, I do the book, I do try to keep it funny. I do try to keep it light and sort of focus on everything, the characters. So like, I would say like, you know, come for the love story and stay for love story, but we'll have a little robot philosophy in the middle and stuff. And I don't know, like, I think that's the hard part about writing a creator-owned book, especially something that you said has like a really, it's like, how do you balance that? It's finding it's finding a way to keep everything driven through character. Who are they? What do they want? How far are they willing to go to get it? And are you able to also use that in a way that actually explores some of the questions and ideas that, you know, that you have in the back? Because I don't think you should ever write a book towards theme. I think that's what novels I think are for, and like, yeah, nonfiction books, like deal with that stuff. Like comic books should should, it's a visual medium and it should drive forward. And that's the great thing about working with Omar. Like, Omar has brought so many great visuals. There's some little things that he drew, that he's drawn, that I have become whole characters and whole subplots because he drew it in the corner of the thing. And I think that's the fun. That's where the medium of comic books can be so insanely rich and limitless, because it literally you have to build the whole world on the page, so nothing is there by chance. I talk a lot. I'm sorry, but thank you for having me on here, man. I really appreciate it, and I hope I wasn't too nonsensical.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, you coming from the world of TV, there's no budget there's not limitations on special effects due to budgetary concerns in comics. It's one of the great things about it. So,
Not the segue, but like, I literally was just watching some of the stuff on the Infinity Wars, and they were saying that Jon Favreau said, he's like, I think the rise in comic movies came with the fact that we were able to do Iron Man in a photorealistic way. Yeah. Like, you couldn't have done it before that. So like, it's interesting. Same thing. It's like, technology is what allowed the story, like certain stories, to become so big. And I think that's one of the things about comic books is so cool. You're not limited. Like, I know Omar does a lot of his work on, he builds everything in 3D and then brings them into the world and draws around them. And I don't necessarily know we would have got the same level of art 10 years ago if he'd drawn this book. So like, that's the other thing, where technology is pushing our ability to make better and bigger comic books and more interesting, and doing stuff visually that I don't think you could do 20 years ago. It's really awesome.
Yeah, it is, because at the end of the day, it's entertainment, right? And I think that goes back to what you were talking about with, you've got to build around character. You've got to care about the character. The characters have to be compelling, because on the surface, it is entertainment. And if you want to read this story just as entertainment, just as a good story, then that's fine. That's great. That's perfectly reasonable. But what's cool is, if you do want to dig in more, there are these big ideas. And you were talking about, being long-winded and whatever. Like, honestly, I had to stop myself from writing talking points, because I was like, I could keep going myself. I could have had 10 or 12 on there and dug in so deep. It's what's so amazing. It has me so excited for this book, because there are so many ideas. And at the end of the day, I think that the stories that I enjoy the most, of the ones that make me think, are the ones that, you know, are reflective of ourself. Like, we're examining the story of these robots, of these characters, as people and on their quest. But what we're really doing is examining ourself. You know, you said it yourself, the human condition. And so it's a reflection on ourself. Like, I can get understanding of why the robots do these things in the story and their motivations, and I can relate to that, and it helps me understand myself and the people around me more, is the way I look at it. So yeah, I
couldn't agree more.
Well, Ryan, I wanted to give you a chance. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners, any upcoming work or anything you want people to know?
Well, first off, I hope they pick up Volition and like it. Let me know if you do or not. Because I think I learned just as much from doing a bad job in writing as I do doing a good job. And if you want to come back, all those talking points you want to stop writing, if you want me to come back when you read the series, we can totally tear into it and see, and you can take me to task on some of those things. That'd be awesome. I'm currently writing, Saban's Go-Go Power Rangers. I've been doing that for about a year. So I would say, if anybody's listening out there and you grew up on the Power Rangers, and you really don't know a lot about the mythology, because I'm still learning, check it out. It's a lot of fun character high school drama stuff, like Buffy and Riverdale. But, you know, every once in a while they, you know, drive giant robot dinosaurs and fight 45th on monsters. So, it's a lot of fun. But like, I try to ground it in character and stuff like that. So that's the only thing I'm working on right now. If you like Volition and you like Power Rangers, those they might be for you.
All right, and if anybody does want to reach out to you after they've checked out Volition, or if they're reading Power Rangers, social media, where's the best place to follow you and find out about your work and reach out?
You can find me at my pretentious handle, at that Ryan Parrott. It's 2 R's and 2 T's.
All right, great. And listeners, I'll put a link to Ryan's Twitter in the show notes, so you can go click there to follow him. So again, Volition, issue 1 just came out on the 8th of August. So if you can find it at your local comic shop, do so. If not, it's available digitally. Comixology, you can go, and I think you can go and order through the Aftershock website as well. Or if your comic shop doesn't have it in stock, they may be able to order it for you. So, and be sure you pre-order the next issue so that you'll be sure to have copies. So again, Ryan, I really want to thank you for joining me. It was a real pleasure. And yeah, we'd love to have you back on to talk about it maybe when the series is over. And what would be even better is if, you know, maybe we do it over a drink or somewhere at a con, and then we could really, really dig in.
Absolutely. You had me at drink. That's fantastic. But yeah, thank you, man, for having me come on. I really, really appreciate it. The fun thing about doing interviews and stuff like that is sometimes in doing the interview, I start to realize what I'm actually saying with the book. You know, like you start, right, as you have to articulate it, you start finding, you're like, oh, wait, that's what I'm writing. Oh, good. So, like, I really appreciate you having me on. And yeah, man, this has been a blast. Thank you so much.
Sometimes it's really good to be like, okay, they are getting what I'm doing. So yeah, it's kind of validating in that way. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. Really appreciate it. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please be sure and check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. I have quite a few shows coming up the rest of the year. The next show I'll be at is Palm Springs Comic Con, the last weekend in August. So if you're going to be there, let me know. I'd love to meet up and find out what you like about the show, maybe even what you don't like, and hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard. So thanks again to Ryan for joining me and talking some high concept with Volition.
And thank you, man. It was great.
No, my pleasure. And we'll talk to you guys next time.